This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3504 for Thursday the 6th of January 2022. Today's show is entitled, James Webb Space Telescope. It is hosted by Dave Morris, and is about 45 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Andrew and Dave watch the launch of the JWST.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Hacker Public Radio. This is Dave Morris, and I'm talking today about the James Webb Space Telescope. I'll probably get that wrong a few times more. So here's the overview. On Christmas Day, that's 2021, at 12:20 UTC, the James Webb Space Telescope was launched. And this is the largest telescope ever sent into space, and the project has been delayed for many, many years. The entire astronomical community, that I listen to a podcast and stuff anyway, was very nervous about the launch after the time that it had taken and the amount of money that had been spent. And they're also nervous about the phase that will follow as the telescope is set up. So there's a lot of work required to get it all configured and ready to go. So I mentioned this launch to my friend and HPR co-host, Andrew Conway. And he, being a professional astronomer back in the day, and myself being quite interested in the subject of astronomy in general, just as an amateur, we got together on Mumble to witness the launch and chat about it. I asked Andrew if he was happy with me recording it as we were starting, and so he was quite happy with that, and that's what we've got here. So basically this show is a little bit of preamble just to bring you up to speed with the James Webb Space Telescope, which is normally called JWST. I'll be mentioning that most of the time. I wanted to just give you a sort of summary of what it's doing. What I've done in my notes is to simply extract the first few paragraphs from the Wikipedia page, which is linked in the notes, and I'll just briefly read through them. There's quite a lot of condensed information in here, and I don't want to bore you to death telling you too much, which you could read for yourself. Partly what I'm doing here is covering stuff that's covered better in other places. So I think mostly it's best if you go and look, if you find it interesting enough from what we talk about. So the JWST is a joint development between NASA in the States and ESA, European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency called the CSA. And it's named after James E. Webb, who was the administrator of NASA from 1961 to 1968 and played an integral role in the Apollo program. It's intended to succeed the Hubble Space Telescope as NASA's flagship mission in astrophysics. So as I've said before, the JWST launch ended up being 25th of December 2021. And it used an Ariane rocket provided by ESA. It's going to be an infrared telescope, that's what it's built to be, which is a different range of light sensitivity than Hubble. And so it's going to be able to spot things that Hubble couldn't. It's going to be doing a lot of investigations across the fields of astronomy and cosmology, particularly some of the most distant events and objects in the universe, such as formation of the first galaxies and that type of thing. Detailed atmospheric characterization of potentially habitable exoplanets, it says. So in other words, they're going to be hunting for exoplanets around very far away stars, and they also will have the ability to detect information about the atmospheres of these planets. So that's a good opportunity to say, that one might be inhabited, because it's got oxygen in the atmosphere, which is not a common thing to find, as far as I understand it. The JWST has a mirror made of 18 hexagons, and they're made of gold-plated beryllium, and it makes a 65-meter diameter mirror, which is much larger than Hubble's, which was 2.4 meters. So the infrared capability will allow it to observe high redshift objects that are too old and too distant for Hubble to see. So that the redshift, I'm a little bit hazy about exactly how that is. It's to do with the fact that the origin of the universe was a time and a distance away, and since creation and the present day, the universe has been expanding. So light that was sent out by the original Big Bang, as it tends to be called, will have changed wavelength, because it's been stretched. It's a thing that light will do. Anyway, the telescope has to be kept very cold to see the infrared without any interference from itself. So it's going to be out in space in a point called the Sun-Earth Lagrange point number 2, L2, which is about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. That's nearly a million miles. And it's going to have a big sun shield. It has a big sun shield facing the sun, which will protect it from the sun's heat. And that in itself is quite an amazing achievement, I think. So the development began in 1996 with a plan for launch in 2007. So you can see how much time has been added to that, with a $500 million budget. But there was lots of issues, and I won't read the whole list here, but lots and lots of delays and problems and things that needed to be resolved. I think the COVID, pandemic hasn't helped. So it's way over time, and it's massively over budget too. I think 10 billion is the figure at the moment. So it was launched from French Guiana, which is close to the equator, because launching things from near the equator gets a boost from the rotation of the Earth. And we watched it and chatted about it as this happened. So I'm going to splice in the audio from that particular event of watching it in real time and talking about it. There was a slight oddity with the audio. There's a background hum from my end, but I've been fiddling with Audacity's notch filter thing to try and remove it, because I think I can't remember what frequency I took out, but it's a little bit less. I think it's because I've got a fan heater in this room and I forgot to switch it off. There's a point about the altitude of the rocket as it was heading up into space. As the final stage was left, everything else had been shed back to Earth. That final stage, it actually reduced in altitude. And Andrew pointed this out, puzzled as to why it was happening. But I've since found a YouTube episode from a guy I follow, Anton Petrov, who talks a lot about these sorts of subjects, explaining that this is one of the necessities for getting a sort of free boost of speed from the orbit around the Earth, the sort of gravitational push, I think. Not 100% certain I understand it, but maybe you will understand better when you come to look if you're interested. We were chatting about another orbital mechanics related mission, which is ongoing at the moment, which is heading to Mercury, but I couldn't remember its name. It's also passing by inner planets to get its speed. I think it needs to speed up on its way to Mercury, and then it needs to slow down. So it's using using other inner planets of the solar system to do this. I couldn't remember its name, but later on I remembered it's called Bepi Colombo. Taking 7 years from launch to get to Mercury. And I think it's due in 2025. That'll be good. So I'm going to just read the last section of the notes and then splice in the audio. So just to say that after launch, and we saw it up until the point that the telescope had detached from the final stage, and we saw the sun, not the sun shield, the solar panels coming out with a live camera from the final stage. So since that point up until now, and today is the 2nd of January 2022, it's on its way to that L2 Lagrange point. And we talked a little bit about Lagrange points in the talk, but it's really hard concept to pass on. I think I don't fully understand how it works, but I quite accept that it does. But you might want to have a look further by following up the Wikipedia article, for example, about how Lagrange points work. So while JWST is on its way to L2, it's getting itself ready. So it's unfolding things which were folded up inside the rocket. And there's a really interesting site which I think it's called a Deployment Explorer. So you can actually scroll through steps of where it's actually going to be at different times, see where it is now and what's happening, with lots of explanation about what's unfolding and how it's working and all that stuff. So the sun shield's getting opened, the mirror itself, which is folded, will be unfolded and so on. Once it gets there, it's going to take another, I don't know, quite a number of months, I think, before everything is set up properly, because they need to calibrate everything and get the mirror set up properly. So there's tons and tons and tons of information about this. And if you follow some of the links I've put in the notes, it should hopefully get you further into the subject. Just the final thing to say is that the launch that Andrew and I watched is visible on YouTube. Hopefully you find it interesting enough to go and dig deeper. Okay, that's all for my preamble, and now we go over to the live recording.
Oh, you're recording this?
Shall we not?
No, that's fine. Yeah, go ahead. I might record it. I should warn you that I'm multitasking. I'm in the kitchen. I've got a schedule for the turkey, but luckily the James Webb Telescope has been launched in a window, because my T-0 when the turkey comes out of the oven is not until past 2. So I've got nothing to do but remove the foil in about an hour's time.
Yep. Just brown it nicely and all that sort of good stuff. Good.
Why are they all walking up the auditorium?
I think that they can actually go and... I think these are the guys actually in French Guiana, are they? I think this is the actual control center at French Guiana. I think they're all journalists and stuff, and they're going to go and see the actual liftoff I would guess, I don't know.
Oh, I see. So that isn't an auditorium. That is, in fact, the control room.
That's the control room, yeah. There's director of operations just now on the screen. So, yeah, I think that's... is it Kourou in French Guiana? Because they were saying...
What are those things? I thought you had an iron in front of them and a bat, but they're models of rockets.
Yeah, they are, yeah. That's an Ariane 5, I think, the one. And there's the real Ariane
5.
Ariane 5 over there. Yeah. So that's the ESA contribution. It's the Ariane 5. So yeah, we're all go. And it's
Vulcan engine about to ignite in 38 seconds.
Yep. They fire up one engine, then 7 seconds wait, they fire up the boosters, apparently. They were telling us in the preamble.
Yeah, I might put the sound on, because I do like the sound of a good rocket engine. Hopefully that isn't the sound of the kitchen catching fire again. I've actually set the kitchen slightly on fire this morning.
Ooh.
Some baking paper poked into one of the gas hob.
Oh, when no.
It was lit. And I, oh, hang on. Looks like we're off.
Yep. We've got a rocket starting up.
Oh.
That's the main engine, I think. And that's the booster. Wow. And there it goes.
Yeah.
My goodness me.
It looks slow when it takes off.
I know. It's just sort of crawling into the air, and then it's going at one hell of a speed. Well, it's accelerating, isn't it? So, because escape velocity is what it needs to achieve, as we as we know very well.
Do you hear that?
What was that?
Well, I got a strange message on my phone saying, well, no. Hearing notifications. I don't know where it came from.
Okay.
What prompted it? Anyway.
So now we're into animation of what's going on up in space or wherever. It's probably not reached space yet, is it? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think they've got another rocket flying alongside filming it.
No.
A grab.
So I don't know. Yeah, they've got a fair way to go to get out of the atmosphere, I imagine.
Do you remember back in the days of the BBC Micro and the 8-bit computers, there was a space shuttle simulator game?
Ooh, no, I don't remember that.
And there was a graph that looked very much like the one that we see in the screen. It looks like a parabola on its side. And showing the, was it altitude of time? And in the game, you had to put in inputs to keep the space shuttle blasting off on that curve. I it was impossible. I could never do it.
No, I never played those sorts of things. I was more into Space Invaders and Galaxians and Chucky Egg, I think was what seemed to get on quite well.
Chucky Egg. Yeah. I think the game, I say it was a game, but I think it was some... faithful. Oh, there's the boosters coming off.
Yep.
It was faithful to the physics, but that didn't make for an entertaining gameplay, alas.
Yes. There was a version of Asteroids, wasn't there, on the Beeb? I seem to recall.
Yeah, several.
I remember playing that, and that's one where you got. It's not proper. Celestial mechanics stuff, but it is, you know, a bit more similar to reality in that you can't whiz off in one direction and stop. You got to spin round and fire rockets in the opposite direction, all that stuff. Which
takes no friction, and you had to
no
respect Newton's laws. Yes, very difficult.
Yeah.
I think my approach was not to move in that game because I couldn't stop again.
Yeah, true, yeah. It was all too easy to find yourself unable to go anywhere that was sensible. Oh, they've separated. What have they done? They've opened the stage which contains the telescope itself. Explain.
It's been jettisoned. I guess now it's clear the atmosphere, it's safe to do that.
Yep. So, because the rest of the journey is 30 days, I was hearing, to get to the L2 Lagrange point. And over the 30 days, they're doing all the deployment of everything. So the whole thing's folded up. So it's got a sunscreen, which is this sort of tinfoily stuff. Is all folded inside, and they have to bring it out, open it out underneath the telescope, such that the telescope can be positioned to point that at the sun, and then look wherever the orb is pointing it at. So that is going to be a thing. The actual mirror also folds out. You can see in the graphic there are three hexagons on the side. Those are part of the mirror, which fold out to be coplanar with the rest of it, which is on the side you can't see. So yeah, it's It's going to be, this is the bit that everybody's scared of, you know, the next 30 days. Is something going to stop these things from unfolding? There's all this sort of stuff that's that people are talking about.
Yes, and just reminding myself that the L2 Lagrange point is about 1.5 million kilometers on the other side of the Earth from the Sun. So if you draw a line from the Sun through the Earth and go, keep going for that 1.5 million kilometers, which is about a hundredth of the Sun distance, then you come to the L2 Lagrange point, which you can orbit because the forces balance out there in a loose sense, the forces balance out. Yeah, it's quite interesting. I did that, all the physics behind that at university, but haven't had to think about it since then.
I was chatting to Ken about this on Matrix this morning, and I think he's watching as well, actually. But he was saying, oh, I do with somebody to come and explain how Lagrange points work. There's a good HBR show there.
So yeah, it's very, it's, I mean, I used to devote almost, I had a 20-lecture course I used to do in astronomy at Glasgow University. You know, for, you know, it was kind of like a non-mathematical but quite rigorous introduction to astronomy. And it took me most of an hour, maybe almost a whole lecture, really, to get through how the tides worked, which is the same idea.
Yeah.
You're moving in a rotating, which is an accelerating reference frame, and it's not easy to, intuitively, it's intuition busting. That's the problem. The only real way to do it, as Lagrange did it, back in the 19th century, I think. Was it 19th century? I think it was 19th century. It was mathematical. So you do it with mathematics first, and then after you've understood it that way, you go back and try and find some intuitive way to interpret the weird results that you get. But it's not easy.
No. Well, I'm sure I've never even tried. I mean, the principle of there being places where there is minimal gravity because there's a sort of cancellation going on makes sense, but how on earth you would tell where they were and stuff is way beyond my knowledge of these things.
Yes, I mean, I need to remind myself. I mean, I like to say that you heard me earlier, I said that the forces balance each other, was what I said. But I think some of the forces you probably described as being fictitious forces, which gives you an idea of why I called it intuition busting.
Yes, yes. Are we getting into centrifugal and centripetal thingies, which one at least,
exactly,
which is fictional, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it feels real when you can feel the irony of it. The forces feel real when you experience them.
So, yeah.
Well, actually, interestingly, the distance, I can't actually see the distance curve elapsed. I've no idea what that means. The distance is actually decreasing at the moment. Oh, no, it isn't. Sorry. What is that? No, altitude is decreasing.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
It's a plot of distance curve elapse in kilometers, whatever that means. Must be projected in the ground, perhaps.
Yeah.
And altitude is decreasing.
Yeah, I see that. The graph is tipping downwards a wee bit, isn't it? Yeah. To get to the L2 point, that they've got to do some sort of bizarre maneuver because it's what did you say? It's behind the Earth. It's a point
L2 is behind the Earth.
Yeah, yeah. So the Sun's in the middle, if you think of it that way. Actually, there's a Wikipedia page about Lagrange stuff, which shows you a picture of it. So that's quite useful. It shows, you know, the L1, L2, L3, L4 and stuff. L2 is behind. So, but I'm not clear what. Yeah, I'm not sure how far away it is. They were talking something about a million. They're talking about a million 1. Miles
5 or million kilometers.
1.5 million. Okay, fine.
Yeah,
fine.
Yeah, 1.5 million kilometers. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
I'm just to correct myself. It doesn't say distance curve elapse. The reason I'm not sure is because the YouTube is right in the limit of the YouTube quality. Tiny, tiny lettering on the graph caption. The x-axis of the graph actually says distance curvilinear. I think it's French for curvilinear, which means I think it's measuring the distance along the ground and the earth. I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Or it could mean it's measuring the distance along the flight path. Maybe that's what it means. Curvilinear means the would refer to a distance measured along a curve. So yeah, that maybe that must be what it is. But anyway, it is weirdly it is descending at the moment in altitude. Quite weird.
Yeah.
But I
don't fully understand that. But there you go.
But it doesn't seem from the subtitles I'm reading that they're all freaked out about it. So
no, they all seem pretty calm about the whole thing. So the launch and getting up into, well, however they're now going to get themselves to L2 seems to be going. They've separated everything out. The main engine is gone, so they're just running on the topmost section of the Ariane rocket, I guess you'd call it. Yeah. So obviously the distance is increasing, but the altitude's going up again now. So quite what that was about, I have no idea.
Yeah, it must have just been an elliptical orbit that it was in, and they thrust into put themselves into the correct orbit. It just is. Altitude, the parameters we've got on the screen is altitude, distance, which must be the distance along the flight path, since it's strictly increasing.
Yep.
And vitesse, which is obviously French for speed.
Yep. So yes, I have no idea what sort of maneuver is needed to get from French Guiana, which is on the equator, they said, and is they go there because they get a bit of a boost from being as this one of the fastest points of spin of the Earth, I think. Is that the right way to put it? And then but quite what they do, presumably have to orbit partially and then zoom off from their Earth orbit in some form or other. I have no concept of how you calculate or understand that.
Yeah, something like that. Now, unfortunately, I was looking at the captions there, and was talking about an apology, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't apology. It meant the word apogee, which means the furthest point from Earth.
Okay.
Because the subtitles are quite badly translated, it's not like they're in French to English, but you know, it's like some kind of machine, artificial intelligence doing the translation. Mistakes words like apology for apogee, which makes it quite hard to follow what's going on.
Yeah, I've turned them off. Those subtitles are awful. It gets so many words wrong.
Yeah, but everybody makes sense. Calls from Carl Starr, the mission. Is it? Well, maybe the mission. There's a guy who works involved in a mission called Carl Starr. Maybe that's what it is.
Yes, I think you just end up not paying much attention to what's going on because you're translating the subtitles. So I found it.
It said it's going to a highly elliptical orbit.
Oh, okay.
And at the moment, it must be doing a burn because its altitude is rapidly increasing.
Yep.
And its speed, its hold is going up as well. So they must be doing a burn at the moment. You can't have that in normal orbit. If you're in elliptical orbit, if you got further out, you would. It's altitude decreasing. As you got further out, your speed would decrease. But if it's increasing, that means they're currently firing the rockets, even though I can't see that on the screen. Oh, you can. In the bottom right.
There's a little graphic. Yeah, little animation, as you said.
Right. Importantly, I've just realised that I've, as well as the, I was saying to you, Dave, earlier, I've got the T-minus for the launch. I've got a T-minus for when the turkey has to come out of the oven. And I've just noticed that I've not put the removing the foil in the right. It's currently at T-minus 1 hour and 10 minutes, but it should be at T-minus 30. So, error there.
You want to do that, otherwise you end up with a rather wishy-washy bit of turkey, don't you? It doesn't get to brown and dry out and stuff.
Yeah, you end up with a burnt, dried-up turkey.
Well, true, yeah, there's that as well. Cool. Okay, so is it worth just if we turn this into an HBR show, right? Do you think it's worth doing a sort of preamble to say what JWST is and what it's going to do and stuff. Because I've been listening to all of the... You can actually go on the YouTube, I think, and hear a fair bit of it. I would imagine they will record that, but I'm not sure. But it's maybe worth doing something like that and then just cut to our chatting about it.
Yes. Yep, that sounds like a good plan indeed, because I'll be honest, I'm actually, despite supposedly being an astronomer, I actually don't know that much about the details of the James Webb telescope, other than obviously it's a placement. It's the next step beyond the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah. Well, I listened to a few, I'm no astronomer, but I listened to a few podcasts where they, astronomy podcasts, and they've been talking a lot about the James Webb. They've been talking about it for years because it's been delayed enormously, it's some people's entire careers have been spent working on the James Webb because, you know, they thought they were going to be doing a few years and then it was going to be launched, and it just kept on and on and on, developing or problems coming up and having to be solved, etc., etc. The podcasters are talking about, you know, what's different between it and Hubble, and what it's going to be used for, and all that sort of stuff.
I mean, I did have the pleasure of working in one NASA space mission, and I came in fairly late and left the project early. I was only on it for a few years, but just as you said, there was people who spent their entire careers on it, and there was one chap in particular, because it stopped functioning a few years ago, and Glasgow was one of the universities that had an interest in it, and so we held wake for it in Glasgow when it finally bit the dust. You know, I think it ran out, and that was the end of it. It didn't function anymore, way beyond its design specification. This was the end, and so we held awake for it because it actually meant quite a lot to people's lives. There was one chap who was probably sadly, I think one of the main principal investigators had died by that point. The other one was getting on a bit, but was still active and researching into it. He's in his 80s. But he was so heavily invested in it, he just couldn't bring himself to attend a wake. He was refusing to have one over in NASA Goddard, which is just outside Washington, D.C. So, but the Glaswegians had no problem, and the French and Swiss folk came over quickly. You know, we had a little day of talks about it, and then we just all went to the pub and did the proper wake in the pub.
That's the way to do it.
For people who don't know, it's the Irish tradition of basically drinking your way through the process on the day of the funeral.
Yes. That's a great idea.
Yeah. In fact, I see the day of the funeral. I think it was probably on the day of the death, I think, of the person. And that's certainly how the tradition came about, is you would, you know, once you heard somebody had died, you would all pile into the pub and start grieving immediately.
Yes, but I think it's got moved to funerals in many, many cases these days, isn't it? I've been to one or two that were sort of effectively awake type of thing after a funeral. Cool. Yes. So, I guess you've got a sort of a hard stop time, I guess, have you now? Because your cooking program requires you to be away, 1 o'clock or something like that, or earlier?
It's about then. I do some preparations that I need to do. I don't need to go right now.
That's fine.
Looking at that graph of flight path versus altitude, it's really climbing quite steeply in altitude. So it's must still be burning away. Although I can't. And the graphic, unfortunately, you can just see the graphic still has the. Still has the booster firing, the little flame behind the spacecraft bit behind the telescope. It's sort of pointing towards the camera for a bit there, so you couldn't really see it, but now you can. still blowing a big burn. Yeah, talking about the upper stage fright, not flight, but fright. I assume that means flight, and that they're not, they don't look frightened.
Yes, yes, the subtitles are a hoot. So yeah, still accelerating. I think it's 966. What is that? 9.67 mean?
It's 9.6. It's the French. Oh, French of course. Instead of decimal points. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
9.7 kilometers per second.
A second.
And it's increasing about every second. It's going up by 0.01 kilometer per second. So it's definitely accelerating. No doubt about that.
Yep, and its altitude is climbing, as you can see from the graph, obviously. So yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be fascinated if there's anything that shows the actual trajectory of this craft, because there were what's the mission that's going to Mercury in the Sun that's going round the solar system several times, getting gravitational boosts from the Earth and from Venus and whatever, and there were various diagrams of this strange path that this thing is taking all over the place.
I'm trying to think which one that was. The one that's going to Pluto, or the one that went to Pluto?
No. Oh yeah, that was also weird, wasn't it? There's something coming up in the next year or two, which is a sun-related thing.
Oh, it's
not the Parker Solar Probe, that's already there, but there's something else. There's a European one, I think, that's coming up.
Yeah, I should know this. Can't think of its name off the top
of my head. No, it's gone out of my head. So the graph said extinction, which I think meant that's when they turn the engines off. So they're not... Well, the graphic shows the engines being off, so I don't know whether that's what it was. Seemed to coincide with the extinction point on the graph. So, strange way of putting, we turn the engines off here.
So you can see the altitude is still increasing. So it's now just over 1,100 kilometers in altitude, but its speed is now decreasing, which tells us that the burn has stopped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now gravity is accelerating it. Yeah, and also there's no graphic of the engine firing anymore.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, there's the graphic there, but the engine is off the left.
Can't see the graph. No, I didn't
notice. Numbers suggest that the engine is not firing now.
Fact, yeah, I did notice that the graphic showed the engine stopping a few minutes ago, a few seconds probably.
See those hexagons there? Now, do you think they're part of the mirror or part of
they
the
are, they
solar
are.
Panels?
Those are panels. Those are beryllium panels, which have been created as sort of integral pieces. Is that the way to put it? They have cast them made castings and then milled them to the specification. So they're beryllium hexagons with a gold layer on the top. And they're using gold because of its reflectance, would you say? In relation to infrared, it's an infrared telescope. Mm. So the telescope is now detached from the. Oh, and everybody's very, very excited because that's.
Yes, they're all clapping.
Yep.
So that must mean that that's the. That must be a few moment for them, I suppose. Yeah. When if there was anything that was going to explode and go badly wrong,
yes,
been averted. Yeah.
So the final stage has shoved it to where it needs to be, and now it can zoom off by auto mechanics and whatever to the L2 point. So how does it? Because it will have sort of positional rockets on it, I would imagine, some sort, won't it?
Yes, because it must. I mean, when you it will orbit an L2 Lagrange point. So it's a bit like orbiting, a mass. You would go into orbit around the L2 point. You wouldn't. Mm-hmm. It'd be impossible to just sit at it, so it will have to enter orbit and it will have to decelerate again, I would think. But maybe actually, because the L2 point is behind the Earth, a a lot of the deceleration is done by the gravitational pull of the Earth. So you can save and rocket fuel that way, I imagine.
Because
there's just the telescope, and I imagine just positioning thrusters left on the telescope itself.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say. I didn't use the right term. Yes, so it's going to be moving itself around a little bit, but mostly it's going to be sitting there with its sun reflector pointing at the sun, sun shield pointing at the sun, and telescope looking outwards. But because it's orbiting the sun, the altitude point is moving around the sun, isn't it? It will be looking at the entire, well, universe, I guess, as it's moving.
Actually, look, the images on the screen just now are not graphics. They're actually camera footage from the booster that it's just detached from.
Oh,
just realised that.
That's exciting.
And the solar panels are unfurling. Look, can you see that?
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so it's quite exciting. So you can see the curve of the Earth. We're having a bit overexposed at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the solar panels are reflecting the sun in quite a... Yeah, that's all a bit overexposed just now, but...
Yes,
real footage.
That's
the last
amazing.
We'll see of it.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's going to be in an inaccessible place, isn't it? Hubble was accessible, so that's how there was a mission that went out there and fixed the mirror, whatever they did. I'm not sure what they did, but it had been ground wrong or something. This one, anything goes wrong with it, that's the end of the story. Well, that's amazing.
It'd be a one-way trip for a space shuttle. Wouldn't be able to, even if we did have space shuttles, we wouldn't be able to get back.
No, it's not. It's too damn far. But yeah, so yes, the hexagons are part of the mirror. So it will actually open out to produce a sort of circular array of hexagons with the hole in the middle. Is that where the camera is? I don't know. I'm not sure the camera's on a boom of the top of it, or the actual optical pickup point type of thing. It'll be that, won't it?
Yeah. Well, I actually don't know. I need to look up the design of the telescope. But obviously the hexagons, I mean, even some big ground-based optical telescopes are made out of hexagons now, because to make one big contiguous mirror, I think the Russians tried to do it. They had the biggest telescope in the world for a while. The problem is when you get to that the mirror is so massive, when you tilt it to look at different parts of the sky, it starts to deform, and obviously that's not on.
No.
You can't have the mirrors deforming even slightly. So the hexagons allow you to pack it up for space flight, but also you can control the shape of the mirror as you tilt it around in the Earth. But in space, I guess it's the packing up aspect that's more valuable.
I think that there was some talk, which I didn't fully understand, about how the individual hexagons can be moved independently of one another, and that might be of use in some contexts, because they're actually going to be looking at things like Europa. They're going to try and get really detailed views of Europa and Titan, and they're also going to be checking out comets, and but they're also going to be looking into the deepest possible space, way beyond what Hubble could see.
Yes, well, on Earth, that's called that technology you referred to, moving them, being able to move the mirrors very precisely and quickly move them.
Mm-hmm.
What they do, they call it adaptive optics, and the idea is that you can actually jiggle the mirrors around very quickly to compensate for the seeing, which is the motion, twinkling actually, the motions in the Earth's atmosphere that distort the image. But of course, that isn't a problem for the James Webb telescope.
No.
There's no atmosphere. But there must be something else, something maybe to do with interferometry, wave interference.
I'm not sure. They're going to be doing some very detailed spectroscopy. Is that the right word? But of course, they're going to be looking at exoplanets with a view to detecting the atmospheres of these things. So they're part of the program is to look for potential planets, planets with potential life or potential, you know, with water, CO2, methane, etc., those sorts of things. And they will, they have designed it so they will be able to spot this by spectroscopy, using the light of the star that the planet transits. That makes sense?
Yes, yes. So what you do there is you look for spectroscopy, you'd look at spectral lines of the star, and you'd see them jiggling backwards and forwards because of the Doppler effect. Because although the planet is doing most of the moving, the star has to move slightly as well. And that's how we detected our first exoplanets. Was
yes, yes.
Noticing that the star was jiggling around.
Yes, due to the effects of the planet orbiting it and stuff, which is
okay. I think at that point I need to sign off, Dave.
Yeah, no problem, no problem.
That was good fun.
Thanks for that. Enjoy your Christmas and have a great turkey.
Yes, thanks. Same to you, Dave.
Yeah, okay. Speak to you soon. Cheers. Okay.
Righto. Bye bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR is kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.